That includes Fosterton, Kurri, Taree, Port Macquarie, Kempsey and Coffs Harbour, and a top of around 20 degrees. So they're pretty spot on today so far. For Thursday, mostly fine with cloud increasing, a top of around 21. And for Friday, chance of a shower, a top of around 19. And on Saturday, a shower or two, a top of around 19. It is 6 minutes past 12 o'clock. You're listening to 2 Bob Radio, your local community radio station here in the Manning Valley. And very soon we'll be talking to Lewis Tillett. But first of all, we'll hear a track from the album we're discussing today, Soliloquy. And the name of the track is A Bitter Pill. Still it there with a track called Bitter Pill from his 2006 album Soliloquy. Oh, that's so hard to say, Lewis.
Isn't it?
And now this album is the last solo album released to date, and it was funded by the Australia Council of the Arts. Welcome, Lewis, officially.
Thank you, Irene.
Now, being funded by the Australia Council of the Arts sounds like quite a turn of events. How did it come about?
After having, you know, we've talked so much about being let down, record companies, all that sort of thing, and deciding not to record anymore, and I'd started playing again live, and I'd been playing mostly in the solo format, and it was suggested to me to why not apply for government funding to record this. So you've got all the material, and a lot of it had been recorded. I just needed help in manufacturing and putting it out. And I'd always been actually quite against the idea of, you know, government subsidies for music. I thought, well, if it can't pay its own way, then maybe it's not, it shouldn't be out there. And I thought, but well, there's a real lot of people who like this, and the just the insane greed, the dog in a manger attitude of all these little record companies that will grab it and then they want to just sit on it and hope that, you know, it's sort of one day it'll, you know, be worth $1 million or something. And they collect probably the majority of Australian artists that way, and then they shelve them. And I thought, no, from the feedback that I've got from people personally and from mail all around the world, I thought, these records mean something to people. I can't afford to do it, and so it gave me the freedom to do that, and so the record was finished and released. It was a bit of a shame that once again the corporate characters got their hands on it, and it ran into problems. There used to be a thing around years ago, and probably still is, that records would sign a band for the world, and people would think, wow, that's great, I'm going to get released around the world. But if you were signed for, say, EMI Sydney, well, the people in Sydney branch of EMI might like you, but no one else has ever heard of you, and they expect to go overseas and think that EMI have heard of you overseas, and it's not the case. And so you're under contract to them, and no one can... And they don't want to put it out, but you can't go to someone else. I've since found out that... those worldwide contracts that I've always avoided can be done with a click of a button on the internet, and a person who was meant to be my catalogue manager just said, oh, we'll put this out on Amazon or something right around the world, which meant it just undermined the relationship that I'd had with these European companies, these small companies, for so long. And they said, well, we can't put it out, which meant promotion. I mean, if no one knows it's out, then it's not much good. And they said, we can't put it out because it's already out on digital download, and we're not going to be able to. We can't afford to promote, you know, a multinational company that's digitally distributing your stuff. So it was a real shame. And at the time also, I'd been invited to go to Germany to play on the 30th anniversary of a festival called Rock Palast, and it was a big deal. And it was also interesting to note that there were out of the four bands, it was on this night that was, you know, big production as far as videoing and broadcast all over Europe and DVDs and that sort of thing. Two of the bands were Australian, and again this catalog manager just said, you know, well, I've got the material now. See you later. And that concert passed me by, so I was unable to attend, and the record didn't quite get to where it was going. It should have gone in Europe, but nevertheless, it doesn't matter because I'm very fortunate in the way that these records don't seem to have a shelf life. They're only as good as the promotion behind them. And I intend to re-release it through these labels in conjunction with some other material, you know, hopefully later this year. So although it was a dreadful feeling at the time, it's, you know, these things blow over, and if you're patient enough, they sort themselves out.
Yeah. So all of the tracks that surface on this that album we've heard on previous albums, it almost appears like a best-of album, but... You might like to explain what that was.
Yeah, the idea of not writing any new songs for this, there are a number of them. One of them was that I'd played almost entirely solo for a number of years, and people at the end of a concert would say, look, we'd love to listen to one of your CDs. What sounds most like what you're playing? And I'd say, well, none of them. And so they said, well, we'd really like to hear, you know, something along the lines of what you've just done. We enjoyed it. So I thought, yeah, the songs, it would be a nice thing to strip them down to just piano and voice and see whether they actually stand for my own personal uncertainty, whether they'd stand on their own as strong songs and not the one song written over and over again. And I think they do. That was a big part of it. It was also to let people know that who would seen me play years before, mostly in a band format, that there was another side to me as well.
Right. So what was happening in your life in 2006?
Well, it's interesting because having just had that sort of, you know, rave about the being let down again, if we remember that last time we spoke and talking about the ECT, I no longer had the burden of this terrible, you know, sort of psych problem, mental condition. So although it was a blow, it was in a weird way, it was nice to know because it was real and it wasn't me who did it or that I was out of touch with reality and which one can easily become a scapegoat if one has suffering from any sort of psych condition and say, well, he's the guy that's where, if things are going wrong, that's where you can look. And that's just not the case, because the guy that they're saying is stuffing it up is actually the guy that's created all these records, my part of it gets done. It's their part that doesn't. So I was able to see it with clarity. So instead of turning the anger on myself and tearing myself apart, I could say, no, this is not me that, you know, messed this up. This is the nature of this horrible industry, and I can certainly say that almost enough said to that. If all the music lovers in Australia realised that this handful of people, what they do, they'd be queuing up halfway across the country to stand in line to see them publicly tarred and feathered, but they sit in their ivory palaces and deprive Australians and Australian artists and the audience around the world from all this great music. But keep persevering.
Yeah. So all of the Electric Shock treatment that had finished.
Yes.
So that was a one-off thing. That was all that you needed, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. They'd talked about sometimes people need to go back for top-ups, if you like, yeah, and top-up treatment. And I was fortunate. I didn't. It was well and truly behind me. So life was very difficult, but in a sense, it was real. It was tangible. I could point to things. Say, yes. Well, and when one can identify problems, then one can address them.
And so, were you still on medication?
Yes, I was on medication, but I'd spent a lot of time off medication, and you know, the high stress. You know, I was always warned. You know, be careful that this can come back, but. Medication that I was put on was far less debilitating, and it was also take it as required rather than this strong dose that needed to be taken regularly. Live your life. If things are starting to get off kilter, this can help you, and along with all of the psychological techniques that I'd learnt over the years, I was able to pull myself back in line, just basically small course corrections, and my health has gone from strength to strength.
Right. So that was... You had the electric shock treatment around
2003, I believe.
Yeah,
it was,
that's right. I think we talked about that last week. Yeah, so that's 7 years ago now.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And another thing that's happened in that time, I was invited to act in a short film, and that was now it's finished. That was a great thing to have done. The director, a guy called Adrian Vandervelt, said that approached me and said, you know, Lewis, can you act? And I said, no. And do you have any interest in acting? And I said, absolutely not. After having been, you know, fried by the music business, I thought, now, I know what the movie business is like.
Oh, for goodness
sake. I'm not going near this thing. And then he said, look, it's only a small, short film. It's no big deal. Yeah, blah, blah. Look, you can do it. And I said, well, look, I'm sure there are lots of people that can do it. And he said, no, only you can do it. And I find it very hard to believe. He put all these obstacles in me. He said, look, that I thought, I put obstacles in front of him that I thought were definite showstoppers, how I could knock this on the head. And for example, I said, look, I can't even remember my phone number. Don't expect me to remember lines. And he said, look, it's a non-speaking part. And so, you know, sort of 17 minutes is a key actor, but you don't have to speak.
Oh.
And there are two other reasons, and he had answers to those as well. And finally, I thought, well, this is just going to be, you know, sort of one camera, sound person, director. And it became more and more involved, and I got involved in the sort of fine-tuning of the script, and that, which is, this is a, you know, sort of pretty odd thing to say, and one would wonder how this is possible, but you'll just have to take my word for it. It is, and it was done, to rewrite a script possibly 20 times that had no dialogue. It's all about expressions and movements and camera angles and all that sort of thing. And when I finally arrived for the filming, it wasn't a small deal. It was you know, people who had worked on, you know, sort of really big movies, and the you know, what was the big trilogy, the Lord of the Rings and all that sort of stuff, and it was a very serious shoot, and then a couple of days out of Fox Studios, and fortunately I'd read the script, the part suited me, and I just turned up there, did it, and the hero was finished. Was hawked around a lot of the international film festivals, got through all the cattle calls, it got right up to shortlisted for Cannes, Venice, Sundance, and so that was great. And unfortunately, was never married to the fact that I was a musician, and so the people in the film world were saying, "Who is this guy? Who is this actor?" And it would have been really good to put the two together, because it's to me, and it's something that I'm hoping that film will be released to the public. It's been shown in the Melbourne Film Festival, and it's an absolutely striking piece of film work, thanks to Adrian and David Knight, who's the director of photography, and people who worked on it, Hilton Media, who produced it.
So what's its title?
Its title is called Hero.
Right, okay.
I could give you a rundown on what it's about, but maybe another time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, soliloquy, I'll kill you for naming it that.
I felt the same when I came up with that title. I thought, people are going to say this guy's been drinking every time I try and say that. You may have noticed I've never said the title.
Yes, I know. Thank you very much. Okay, so it was your last solo album that's been released, but there is another album, yes?
Yes, there is. It's an album that's been in the making for maybe 10 or 15 years, and when I mastered Soliloquy, I was also able to put the final... There's little time left over in the mastering studio, and put the final touches on this thing called... It's called To Ride a Dead Pony. Yeah, the title, to me, a lot of people think that's a strange title. I mean, I might as well give it away, you know, flogging a dead horse. And,
yes.
Earlier you asked if Soliloquy was a collection of greatest hits. This one isn't either. It's a collection of rare recordings. Again, trying to fill in the audience, the European audience, for example, who are listening to be playing only solo in this very introspective type of music. It's recordings from a lot of rock bands that I played in. It's a really quite an edgy rock and roll album. Early Wet Taxi singles, a whole lot of interesting rare recordings, and that ties in with when you mentioned about Australia Council of the Arts. I also got when the Soliloquy was finished, I got a call from the National Film and Sound Archives. They said, could we have permission to play this in our foyer down there in Canberra? And I said, of course. And that got my mind to thinking, and back to that idea of grants. Well, that's public money, and all of this stuff, should go back to the public, and thinking that, you know, that this never-ending debacle, one from another, from record labels, halting the progress of so many records, that it started me thinking, how about this all just goes back to the Australian public, and it's just free for everyone, instead of just putting it on the internet for free, let's put it in the National Film and Sound Archives, plus all of the, as we've been talking for the last, 11 weeks or so, 10 weeks, whatever, there's a lot more, and we just have these all too short conversations, so I'll be spending a lot more time expanding on that. All the information, photographs, other people's stories will be invited to contribute, and it'll become a collection of the National Film and Sound Archives, not just as a museum piece, but for people to be able to link that this Australian music has had an incredibly broad impact on the world, and a lot of these bands have had a huge influence in Europe, and nobody knows about it. They say, oh, that's just that little pub band playing down the road. Every time I'd go to Europe, no one had ever heard of what was charting in Australia, but they knew everything about these Sydney pub bands. The Sydney pub bands, I can tell you for a fact, influenced the whole Seattle sound, the grunge thing. Nirvana, for example, they were touring in France when I was over there. And basically no one would give them a gig after the end of that tour, and they were wondering what to do, and I had places that I played in Australia, and they were offered some gigs in places that actually, some venues, pubs that I lived in, and they thought, oh, that's great, and right at that time their first album went number one in America, and people like Kurt Cobain said, the American label said, you've got to come back to America now, forget about playing those small gigs, you can play, the big time over here. And they said, no, you can wait. We're going to Australia and we're going to play these small gigs. So all of these big bands were playing the pub circuit in Australia. And they said, then we'll go back because you made us wait. You can wait for us. But as we know, how many of those people were also destroyed by the big American machine. So
yes.
Now I've forgotten what the
the original question
was. Yeah.
The original question was that there is another album, but it hasn't been released. So
oh, yes.
I suppose if we cut to the chase now, and when do we think it might be?
I'm hoping within the next few months.
Oh, excellent!
And that's right. That's where I lost my train of thought.
Yes,
these are recordings that directly influenced a lot of these bands overseas. I mean, my first album called Ego Tripping at the Gates of Hell, only a few years ago there was an American band called The Flaming Lips, and the album was called, number one, called Ego Tripping at the Gates of Hell, and people were saying, oh, Lewis, where did you come up with that title, was that a William Burroughs or something? I said, no, that's Lewis Tillett, and the White Stripes, when they did their first album, someone played it to me, and I could actually say, oh, they've taken it from that band and that band and that band and that the band, almost all Australian bands.
Mm.
And I could hear the songs in there, and it was quite interesting that they did their first tours in Australia. So I'm actually talking to the National Film and Sound Archives now, and this record, To Ride a Dead Pony, when it comes out, will be a, rather than a summing up, which I expected it to be, rather launch of the next step, which will be let's start letting people know about what influence Australian music has had around the world. A few weeks ago, it was National Sorry Day, and a lot of the bands that you're playing in here, Coloured Stone, Warumpi Band, No Fixed Address, those bands were just small pub bands here in Australia. Overseas, everyone knew about them. And here we are in Australia saying we have to find some sort of cultural identity. And in every time I go to Europe, they don't want to know about the Harbour Bridge. They don't want to know about the Opera House. They don't want to know about the politics. They want to know about who are these Aboriginals. And there's such a fascination and awe about this culture. And outside of Australia, Australia's already has a national identity. I can tell you, it doesn't need to be. You don't need a marketing person to come up with a new theme. We've got 100,000 years worth, you know, and,
yes,
and it's in music. You know, it's an oral tradition and it's an art tradition and those great people are actually and a lot of them wouldn't even know it themselves what an influence that they've a flagship they've been for Australia around the world, and something sadly neglected, and I hope to be rectified.
Yes. Now, a lot of people, disc jockeys, whatever, like to label a particular artist. Like they like to put a label on what their music is. If you had to put a label on your music, could you? Would you? What is it?
Yeah, I've been asked that a few times, and more than a few. Two labels for different types. One of them was, I call it medieval blues.
Right.
And the other one was punk jazz.
Right, okay. All right, now we know.
Yeah.
Because it is a tricky one with your music, trying to put a label on it. Yeah.
And the punk jazz actually, I must have said that to a couple of journalists, because I think if you look on the internet, there's a genre called punk jazz.
Or
jazz punk, you know, but I haven't seen the medieval blues anywhere.
All right. Okay, now we're going to go out with a track from this album that we haven't played previously from any of your other albums, and it's called An Ancient Song. And now I believe this particular song is very, very special to you.
It's special to me and also to a lot of other people. Very briefly, I wrote it a long time ago. It's one of the few songs that I remember particularly where I got the inspiration. I was playing in Thessaloniki in the north of Greece, and there was in another part of the building there was a Greek diva, if you like, playing these traditional Greek songs, and there were people just sobbing in the audience, and there. You know, and their heads down on the stage weeping, and I thought, to be able to write something with that depth. It was also the time of some serious problems, ethnic problems in Europe and traditional music, and so an ancient song. It's not meant to be any one particular culture, anything. It was an attempt to really get at the heartstrings of something, a song that has been around forever and shall be, but not the particular song, the spirit. And I have a friend in Thomas in Germany, and a number of Thomas friends in Germany, but this one guy in particular, he actually did a lot of the guitar work for Curtis Mayfield and those famous recordings that you might remember of, you know, Supergrass and, you know, Pushman and all that sort of stuff, that wah-wah guitar behind, and he swears that he can tell every time that I play it anywhere in the world. He believes it resonates in some higher vibration, in a pretty cosmic sort of guy, but I like to think it does, it's a song that, you know, you just asked what type of music is it. Well, there is no genre to this. This is just music.
Yes. All right. Well, we're going to look forward to listening to that. And next week is our final week, so
yes,
we're going to have do a bit of a wrap-up of the last, it'll be 10 weeks or so, 11 weeks next week. So, yes, we'll have lots to talk about next week. And
And I'll bring in a copy of To Ride a Dead Pony. So, there's a few pieces on there that are worth playing and can open up conversations about a lot of different things.
All right, terrific. Okay, thank you, Lewis Tillett. And we will go out now with an ancient song from the 2006 solo album, the last album released so far, Soliloquy.
Soliloquy. And I'd just also like to mention Andrew Hagar, who did the original artwork for it, a fine Australian painter.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lewis.
You're welcome.
See you next week.
I'll see you then.
Sound of the brawling waves when down the wishing well. Standing on the edge with daggers drawn, cut to the bow of the golden dawn. In the morning, if you are gone, I'll bless the bringer of oblivion. If it's a dream and I was wrong, bask in the sound of an ancient song.
Lewis Tillett there, and the ancient song from the 2006 album Soliloquy. It's time now for